Welcome to The Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. I'm Susan Wall, and I'm reading August Gale by Maine author Barbara Walsh, copyright 2012 by Barbara Walsh, and published by GPP in Guilford, Connecticut. Today we're beginning episode 14, which begins on page 189 of this 247-page book. In the previous episode, Barbara's Newfoundland cousins shared how her grandfather Ambrose had asked them to take his ashes to sea for burial. He had died in California at age 81 in 1990, and the cousins obliged, playing a sad song at the ceremony at Ambrose's request. The words to this song, Maggie, made Barbara wonder if Ambrose perhaps regretted the poor choices he had made in his life. The other major development in our last episode was the increasing doubt among Patty's friends, family, and Lillian herself, if the body in her parlor awaiting burial was that of Patty or Tom Reed. Despite all objections, Father McGettigan insisted it surely was Patty. At the end of the episode, Patty's friend Bernard was about to examine the cheeks of the corpse. He knew Patty carried a definite scar. And now, episode 14. Bernard studied the body's face. He eyed both cheeks. "'Tis not there. The scar is missing." Bernard eased himself out of the room, as Patty's nieces, Ernestine and Gertrude, stood in line, waiting to pay their respects. Gertrude could barely stand from the shock of her favorite uncle's death. She couldn't imagine seeing Uncle Patty with all the life and fight drained out of him. Gertrude also feared that her family might soon be preparing their own wake. Her father, Ernest, and his crew had still not been heard from. In the darkened parlor, Gertrude knelt before her cousin Frankie, offering prayers for the young boy and his two older brothers, Jerome and James. She turned to the larger body and gazed at the face, noticing that it was thinner than Patty's and the hairline was a bit off. She gasped and answered her sister's wide eyes with a whisper, "That's not Uncle Patty." Beyond the captain's doors, a crowd of mourners collected in the meadow surrounding Patty's home. Men sipped rum from the flasks they'd hidden in their coat pockets and swapped stories about who they believed rested in the coffin. "By Jesus, 'tis not Patty, no boy, and Father McGettigan himself saying so. Surely the missus would know her own husband now, wouldn't she? 'Tis the queerest wake I've seen, aye, boy." The men lowered their voices as they watched Tom Reed's sons, Billy and Emile, slip inside Patty's home. The boys had heard the rumors about the mismatched bodies, and they were not eager to set their eyes on their father's corpse. They nudged their way past the mourners and fixed their sights on the large man lying in the coffin. They recognized his ruddy cheeks, the thick arms that had rowed dories and hauled quintals of cod. Emile couldn't speak the words that bubbled from his older brother's lips. "That's Dad!" The reality of losing their father hit them in the face like the cold Labrador current. No more would they stand on the hill beside their home, waiting for a sight of their dad on board Patty's ship. The boys remembered how their father always hugged and kissed his six children before he left for sea. "Take care of yourselves now," he'd tell them, their mother standing in the doorway, the worry spreading across her brow like a fever. Like many of Marystown's fishermen, Tom Reed had tried to ease his wife's fear. "The Blessed Mother will protect me," he told her. Their dad never boarded the schooner without the miraculous medal around his neck. Billy and Emile took one last look at their father's face before blessing themselves. Silently they prayed that the Blessed Virgin had watched over their dad in his final moments. Uncertain of what to do next, they searched the faces of the mourners, their eyes pleading for guidance. "Is everyone daft? Doesn't anyone know this is our dad?" The boys backed away from the coffins, looking for someone they could talk to. Still, they knew it would do little good. Who would believe them? Billy was barely 18, Emile 15. Who would heed such an outlandish story from the sons of a penniless fisherman? Shaken and bewildered, the boys trudged down Patty's hill, not eager to head back home where their mother waited. Other mourners weren't as solemn. As they strolled out Patty's door, several couldn't help sharing a laugh at the irony of a poor dory-man laid out in the King of Marystown's parlor. "Aye," they agreed, "Tom Reed's getting a fine farewell for himself." The laughter drew the scorn of the women who had collected in the field. They shook their heads and rubbed their rosary beads as they shared their own opinions. "There's not a thing to be joking about now, is there? The whole town's gone mad with all this talk of switched bodies. What's the difference when there are 42 children left fatherless? How do they carry on now, with barely anything to eat and the long cold winter ahead?" Out of respect or grief, nearly every home on Marystown's southern shores had pulled its shades, mourning a son, a father, a brother, cousin, or uncle lost on the Annie Anita and Mary Bernice. Really now, the women agreed, wasn't Patty's farewell a wake for them all? No matter whose body rested in the coffin, 'twas the only man the sea had returned. Chapter 26. Ambrose Continues to Haunt. Marystown, 2003. Fine china and crystal decorate the dining table. We feast on silver capelin, potatoes, and prime rib, raising our wine glasses to toast our first journey home. A few nights before we are to leave Marystown, Alan Brenton has invited us to dinner. We sit, my sister, father, and I, in between Alan and Jack's family. Conversation spills from four corners of the table, and there is much laughter as stories are swapped about our respective families and lives. Throughout our week we have felt welcomed, and indeed as if we were home. The Brentons have done everything possible to make our stay comfortable and help us connect with families who lost their kin to the August gale. They treated us, my father will later say, like royalty. Sufficiently satiated after cake and coffee, we settle into Alan's living room, where Jack suggests we watch a video of Ambrose's 80th birthday celebration in Marystown. Knowing that Joni and I have never met our grandfather, Jack offers the film as a way for us to glimpse Ambrose, to get a sense of his personality. The impromptu suggestion catches my father by surprise. He is not eager to view the video, but he does not want to offend. Standing in the corner of the room, he is quiet, steeling himself for an unwanted visit with Ambrose. Joni and I sit on the couch, curious about what the movie will reveal and concerned about how it will stir our father's emotions. The video opens with a couple dozen people gathered around Alan's family room bar. Ambrose stands in the center of the crowd. At 80, my grandfather is strikingly handsome, muscled, and fit. His black hair is still thick and black with flecks of gray. Traditional Newfoundland music plays in the background, and Ambrose is surrounded by his family and friends. His dark eyes flash as he grins, savoring the attention. As Ambrose begins to dance, twirling a woman around the room, Joni whispers to me, "This is bizarre." I nod, mesmerized by the image of our grandfather, who is so alive, so vibrant. It is as if a ghost, an apparition, has walked into the room. I glance up at my father, knowing he is confronting his own phantoms. His lips are pressed tightly together, and he rocks back and forth on the balls of his feet. He considers leaving the room, but forces himself to stay, to watch. A cake with numerous candles is presented to Ambrose, and he blows the tiny flames out amid cheers and clapping. "This is quite an honor and a surprise," Ambrose says, his laughter echoing in the room. "You son of a bitch," my father silently curses. He has not seen Ambrose for 55 years. The last time was in 1948, before Ambrose stepped into a San Francisco bookie shop to bet on the horses. While my grandfather gambled, my grandmother lay in a hotel bed, threatening to jump out a window. I stare at my father's eyes. They are wide and dark with rage. I can only imagine his resentment, the contrasting memories that flicker through his mind, the images of his mother, devastated, shamed, heartbroken, and now the pictures of Ambrose, jubilant, charismatic, the cherished hometown boy. The room is suddenly too small. I hear Joni's breathing, her sighs, as she exhales her own confused emotions. "This is too much," she tells herself, feeling guilty for asking our father to come to Newfoundland, to relive a past he would rather forget. "I shouldn't have pushed Dad to come here." The film ends, showing Ambrose on another day, walking around Alan's pool with his grandson. Ambrose holds the child's hand. The boy is 5 or 6, and I think of my father, once a young boy of the same age, his palm locked inside Ambrose's hand, safe, secure. The screen dissolves to black and someone shuts off the television. The Brentons realize the film has upset my father, and they apologize. It's okay, he tells them, knowing they were trying to share a celebrated milestone in Ambrose's life. It is late, and we thank the Brentons for dinner and head outside to our car. My father's sneakers kick up stones from the gravel driveway, and the sound seems unnaturally loud in the still night air. In the distance, Patty's house is silhouetted in the dark. I consider my great-uncle's wake, the contested and curious gathering, to bid the skipper farewell. No matter whose body lay in the casket, friends and family gathered to pray, to mourn, to accept the death of a fearless and famed captain and his crew. I recall Ambrose's final wish, his self-designed wake. Had he the chance, would my dad have attended, listened to the stories, added his own memories before the wind carried his father's ashes into the sea? Would a wake have helped mark Ambrose's passing, providing finality, an easing of my father's animosity? Somehow my grandfather does not seem departed. There are too many emotions, unanswered questions, and mysteries to put him to rest. I breathe deeply and glance at the stars. I wonder if Ambrose's spirit, his soul, understands that we are here in his home, resurrecting the past. A few years before he died, Ambrose speculated about his journalist granddaughter, musing that maybe I had inherited his loquacious manner, a trait that would have benefited me in my reporting career. He marked my progress through my Nana's correspondence. She sent him the stories I wrote and informed him about the 1988 Pulitzer Prize my newspaper won for articles on escaped first-degree killer Willie Horton, Jr. and Massachusetts' flawed prison furlough program. I was one of two principal reporters who had worked on the year-long series, and my Nana had proudly shared this news with my grandfather. Intrigued by my journalism career, Ambrose harbored hope that maybe one day I would grow curious about my California grandfather, track him down, and visit. "I wonder, would she come this way and try to look me up?" he had asked a family friend. "But then," Ambrose quickly added, "I suppose she would have no reason to." 13 years after he drew his last breath, I want to talk to my grandfather, to ask him questions, to seek resolution and understanding. I wish I had sought him out, realized that one day I would regret not meeting, never knowing him. The scent of the Newfoundland sea fills the air as I turn to the night sky. From Alan Brenton's driveway, I gaze at the string of stars, the gauzy stretch of the Milky Way. I am here. I've come looking for you. What do you want me to find? What do you want me to know? Chapter 27. Digging Up the Grave, Marystown, 1935. The fishermen followed the boy with the white cross. Dressed in their tattered Sunday suits, the men pulled a wooden cart along the dirt path. They took small steps and kept a careful eye on their precious cargo, the two pine coffins that cradled the remains of Paddy Walsh and his young son Frankie. The church bell tolled, marking their solemn procession. Outfitted in their long black dresses and dark jackets, men, women, and children formed a ragged line behind the wagon. More than 200 had come to pay their final respects to Captain Paddy. Many rose before sunrise, walking distances of 5, 10, and 20 miles from the villages of Fox Cove, Spanish Room, and Burin. Families from Little Bay, Beaubois, and Duracle crowded into their dories and rowed along Mortier Bay to the northern shore of Marystown. The mourners' faces were somber beneath their caps and black veils. Yet their eyes couldn't hide their disdain and disbelief. They nodded to one another, declaring their contention in hushed voices. "Queerest thing to be carrying on this charade, burying Tom Reed as Paddy Walsh. No sense of it at all." Despite their doubts, they filed through the doors of the Sacred Heart Church, careful to keep their grim humor hidden from Father McGettigan's ears. The Walshes, Brentons, Powers, Reddys, and the Reeds made their way toward their wooden pews, the hierarchy of their wealth, or lack of it, placing them in their proper seats. Billy and Emil Reed climbed the stairs to the church balcony and settled in their places, farthest from the altar and the coffins. The young men had not spoken to their mother about what they had witnessed at the wake. They couldn't find the words to tell her. "Ma, they've made a mistake. They're burying Dad." She would have cuffed their ears and scolded, "Stop your nonsense and say a prayer for your poor father." Their mother hadn't stopped sobbing since McGettigan came to their door with the grim news. They didn't dare push her further into grief. Still, none of this made any sense. The boys wished they could ask their dad for help. He was a strong and stubborn Scotsman who had worked long hours at sea to put food before his family. In the years before his death, dark circles permanently smudged their father's eyes. A weariness clung to him like the scent of cod that lingered on his boots. No matter how many barrels of fish he caught with Skipper Paddy, it never seemed to be enough. It had been several months since they had tasted a bit of beef or butter. Like many of Marystown's families, the Reeds survived on the cabbage and potatoes, carrots and beets that grew in their garden. "Count your blessings, boys," their mother often told them. Now that their father was gone, the boys didn't feel so blessed, and the struggles their dad had endured to provide for the family would now fall on their young shoulders. Their mother had already confessed to her sons that she might have to put one or more of her children in the St. John's orphanage. "There are too many mouths to feed," she'd told them. "Too many, dear God." Now, as they eyed the coffins resting before the altar, the boys prayed for their dad and their family, knowing the months ahead would test them all. Below the balcony, the bereaved fell silent as Lillian Walsh and her four surviving children slowly shuffled down the center aisle. Village women stifled sobs as they glimpsed Lillian's pale face, her slow, unsteady walk. "Aye, she still isn't with us," the women whispered. "She mustn't have a clue to where she is. God bless the poor thing." As many of the mothers in Marystown had tried, Adela Power did her best to console Miss Lil. Adela understood the painful loss of a child. Her own son, Ernest, had drowned in the bay on All Souls' Day. He'd taken over the wheel of the David and Lizzie while the captain had gone below. The boy was never seen again. The skipper believed the young man had somehow fallen overboard and drowned in the harbor just a mile from his home. Adela remembered Father McGettigan and Dr. Chester Harris coming to her door, their faces pinched, hands folded. She had collapsed onto the kitchen floor after they had told her Ernest was gone. 2 years had passed since that day, but the grief still pierced her heart like a winter wind. Adela could not fathom Lillian's sorrow. "How do you carry on after losing three sons and a husband to the sea? There'll be no getting over it. Sweet Mother of God, you'll be driven mad." Father McGettigan stood before the pulpit uttering prayers for the souls of Captain Paddy, his sons, Frankie, Jerome, and James, along with the other 11 Marystown fishermen lost in the gale. The Latin words tumbled from the priest's mouth. He knew the phrases as well as Shakespeare's sonnets. "Eternal rest give to them, O Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon them." As the priest spoke, the mourners silently mused about the charade unfolding before them. "A shame they're burying the wrong man. I can't make no sense of it at all. Tom Reed in Paddy's coffin, and soon to be buried in Paddy's grave." Young children squirmed in the church pews and covered their noses as the earthy scent of incense rose from the altar. Chanting Latin prayers, McGettigan sprinkled holy water onto each of the two caskets. Before he could return to the pulpit, a loud bang startled the priest and the church full of mourners. The wooden doors of Sacred Heart slammed shut as a messenger boy walked briskly toward the front row, where Ernest Walsh's family sat. Knowing that the telegram could bear ill news of her missing husband, Cecilia Walsh made the sign of the cross and uttered a quick prayer, "Dear God, have mercy on us." As the boy leaned over the pew to deliver the small sheet of paper, McGettigan commanded from the altar, "Bring it here." Gertrude Walsh held her breath and prayed that the message did not bear news of their father's death. "Please, Lord, spare our dad," she pleaded. McGettigan fell silent as he read the small black words. He cleared his throat and informed his parishioners, "Let us thank the Lord for this welcome news. Ernest Walsh and his crew made safe harbor from the gale. They are alive in St. Pierre." Gertrude and her sisters collapsed against one another, weeping with relief. Their mother quickly prodded the girls. Wiping away her own tears, she told her children, "Hush now, there are plenty of other families who aren't so fortunate." The girls turned toward their Aunt Lil, seated a few pews away. The widow's shoulders convulsed with sobs, her weeping muffled by the organ that echoed in the cavernous church. Women reached for their handkerchiefs as fishermen carried the coffins from the altar. Accompanied by Lillian's cries, which had grown to high-pitched wails, the men slowly made their way from the church to the burial grounds of the Sacred Heart Cemetery. Dorymen and skippers shook off sudden chills as the caskets of the 12-year-old boy and Captain Paddy were lowered into the earth. The men couldn't get out of the boggy cemetery quickly enough. The screams of the skipper's widow would haunt them more than any of the gale winds they had heard at sea. The bodies had been in the ground less than 24 hours, when Lillian's mind began to clear from the tranquilizers. The thought struck the widow like a sudden summer storm. The scars! The scars will tell the truth! As sure as Sunday, she knew that the body they had buried was not Paddy. The marks, she told herself, will end this travesty. The morning after the funeral, Lillian sent a message to Father McGettigan. "The body in the grave is not my husband's. Either you exhume him, or I will do it myself." Soon after he received the note, McGettigan arrived at her door. Lillian explained that both her husband and Tom Reed had scars that would identify their bodies. A loose pinwheel from a boat motor had permanently disfigured one of Paddy's knees. A scar branded Reed's right shoulder, marking where he fell on his axe while chopping trees in the woods. Lillian demanded that the priest dig up the body that rested in her husband's plot, and the widow had another request for McGettigan. "Please check on Frankie, too. What if the body in his grave is really that of his older brother Jerome?" "Both your boys are gone, Lil," McGettigan told her, his voice sharp with irritation. "What's the difference which one is buried, in the grave or in the sea?" McGettigan's mood had soured since he had received Lillian's request. He wanted no part of exhuming a body that had been buried the day before. There had never been a body dug up in the history of Marystown, and McGettigan didn't want to be the first priest to oversee such a desecration. The whole town had gone mad, McGettigan thought. He couldn't walk the footpaths without meeting the eyes of a grieving widow or a fatherless child. The entire community slowed to a standstill. Several schooners had not left the bay since the storm. The shades of most homes remained pulled, the dwellings dark with sorrow. Many years would pass, the priest reckoned, before his congregation would recover from this terrible loss. Even McGettigan himself struggled to wake himself from a netherworld of shock and sadness. The priest shivered at the thought of the roaring wind that had shaken the presbytery's roof, and there was no forgetting what he viewed on his doorstep the night of the gale. McGettigan knew that many of his parishioners believed in tokens, spirits that foretold of death, but the priest had little belief in such foolishness. The only spirit he believed in was the Holy Ghost, and he scolded himself for sharing his vision of Paddy and his crew with his maid. Now it seemed everyone in town looked at him queerly, thinking he was as daft as the town's grieving widows. Still, there were other strange things that had occurred since the hard rain lashed his windows. The priest had begun to hear odd sounds as he walked through the church. Hooks, like those hanging on the trawl lines, rattled unseen, hidden in the shadows. McGettigan had shouted in the darkened sacristy, "Who's there?" His voice echoed in the empty church, his fear rising to the rafters. He had departed from the building quickly, discounting the odd noises. "I just need a good night's rest," he told himself. Still, he couldn't shake the image of Paddy on his doorstep, his old friend staring at him with vacant, unseeing eyes. As if he weren't tormented enough, now Lillian was demanding that he dig up Paddy's body. Knowing he had little choice but to put the rumors to rest, the priest reluctantly gave in to the widow's request. McGettigan informed the local doctor and the constable of his decision. The three men agreed to examine the body the following day, before the flesh could further decompose. Along the dirt paths, the fish wharfs, in shops and kitchens, word about the exhumation passed from mouth to mouth like a fire in the dry September woods.
"Did ye hear? McGettigan's digging up Patty's grave. Aye, the body never should have been buried there in the first place."
Pre-dawn fog crept into the Marystown harbor as men with pickaxes and shovels headed along the dirt path to the boggy woods of Sacred Heart Cemetery. A small motorboat cut across the bay, ferrying the doctor and the constable to the northern shores of Marystown. Two young lads, Huey Ducey and Bernard Butler, sat quietly among the men. As the boat neared the mooring, the skipper cut the engine and warned the boys, "Ye stay here till this business is done." Huey and Bernard nodded. From their seats, they watched the men disappear over the hill leading to the graveyard. Once their backs slipped from sight, the boys jumped from the boat, running into the woods that bordered the cemetery. They settled behind trees for cover, hushing each other as they eyed the crowd gathered at Patty's grave. McGettigan stood by the freshly dug plot, cursing the dozen men who had shown up for the spectacle. Billy Mitchell placed himself at the front of the grave, his bloated face mocking the priest with a toothy grin. Three young men stood quietly with their shovels, waiting for McGettigan's orders. Tom Reed's eldest son, Billy, held his spade, nervously shuffling his feet, fearing whose body they'd find beneath the earth. The 18-year-old didn't relish the gruesome task ahead of him, but he couldn't stand the thought of his dad resting in the wrong grave. Shaking off the morning cold, the priest shouted to the men, "Get on with it!" The pickaxes and spades struck the ground, and the piles of dirt grew taller as the men removed the earth covering the two coffins. Mitchell took pleasure in the look on the priest's face. McGettigan's cheeks grew redder with every strike of the spade. The priest sighed as the pine boxes grew visible. "Pull Patty up," he ordered. The men carried the casket to the grave's edge and removed the nails from the wooden cover. No one spoke as the crowd viewed the body. A few of the men stepped back and blessed themselves. They knew your luck could turn after touching a corpse, that strange things could happen to those who disturbed the dead. McGettigan glared at the superstitious fisherman and pulled a knife from his pocket. The priest bent over the coffin. His thick arms raised the body upright. Without a word, McGettigan slashed the back of the coat covering the broad shoulders. The ripped cloth tore to reveal a long red scar, the gash Tom Reed suffered from his own axe. Billy Reed stared at the blackened face of his father. "Dad!" he cried. McGettigan dropped the body back into the coffin and turned from the grave with a final command. "Carry him up the hill and bury him in the Reed's plot." Tom Reed's sons carried their father's coffin up a small knoll and began digging their dad's grave. The boys would later build a large wooden cross to mark the plot where their mother would stand for hours, weeping and praying for her lost husband. While Reed's sons toiled in silence, two other men tossed dirt back onto Frankie Walsh's coffin. McGettigan wasted no time in leaving the cemetery and the dreadful mess behind him. Black robes slapping his heels, he retreated to the parsonage, where a bottle of rum waited. Billy Mitchell patted his bountiful belly and laughed. "Big Bull McGettigan won't soon forget this one." "Aye, Billy," muttered one of the grave diggers. "I'm sure ye won't be letting him." We've reached the end of episode 14 of August Gale by Barbara Walsh. I'm Susan Wall. Thank you for listening.